Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back to Ecclesiastes Round 2. So we've been looking at Ecclesiastes, and we've been discussing this issue, that Christians today are busy shouting the answer to a people who don't know the question. And Ecclesiastes is the question. In a world that's oversaturated with information and technology and noise, the signal, right? The internet, TV, your phone, they used to be left in your house, attached in your house, now is attached to your hip and everywhere you go. You can get service out in the wilderness even, so that even while you're seeking solitude, you still have your phone, you still have the whole world connected to you. In a world that's full of noise, what Ecclesiastes means to do is create silence. Silence. So Ecclesiastes silences our busyness and asks deeper questions. In fact, questions that our busyness and our pleasures tend to hide. Those deeper questions of what is the meaning and purpose of your life? What is the greatest good? What should you devote your whole self, your time, and all your energies to? What are you devoting those things to presently? Etc. So, Solomon lines out for us five different pursuits. And again, none of these are wrong in and of themselves. The first pursuit is wisdom. In fact, he tries each one of these. The second is pleasure. So the first is a pursuit of wisdom, of knowledge, of the heights of reason and human intellect, learning. The second is pleasure, not in an unsophisticated caveman sort of way, but rather seeking pleasure, seeking that which is distinctly good from that which is not. Seeking to live life in a way where one pursues the good things, distinguishes between those that are good and those that are excellent, and that's an entire pursuit, an entire way of life. The third is greatness, which involves wealth, but also power. And greatness can take on many forms, but it's not the idea of tying yourself to greatness is money or greatness is wisdom. It's rather devoting yourself to becoming a great person, whatever that may be, and devoting yourself to a great cause, whatever that may be. And again, if this is at all familiar to you and you have a background in Saddleback Church, it's because that's exactly what you were taught Christianity is. It's the pursuit of greatness. In Ecclesiastes, that's just one of the five pursuits, one of the five toils. Nothing inherently wrong with it, but in the end, it's not the answer. Okay, the fourth is surprising, philanthropy, altruism, living your life for others. Remember last week we talked, you know, what is it, what are you living for? And some people would say, I'm living for my kids. You know, everything I'm earning is basically going to go to them. I'm around to support them. I'm living for my kids. What does their life mean? Solomon says, vanity. Vanity of vanities. Says the preacher, vanity of vanities, the all is vanity, including the lives of your children. So even if you push it off a generation, so to speak, and say, I'm living for my children, you're still living for vanity, which is to say that even philanthropy, even altruism, even a self-sacrificial life ultimately is a toil that comes out as vanity. Again, there's nothing wrong with living that way, but realize its limitation. It's not the end-all, be-all. It's not the meaning of life. Solomon himself tries each of these. Wisdom, pleasure, greatness, philanthropy, and last but not least, religion. Religion itself, as a way of life, is only a pursuit, only a toil. And ultimately, in the end, it also is vanity. So what Solomon is doing is posing the question, what is the meaning of your life? What is the greatest good? What is the thing that you ought to pursue? And he is taking the collective wisdom of mankind and he applies himself to each of these. not sitting in his throne room, not academically. He actually details how he tries to live each one of these toils or pursuits. He puts on wisdom and sees where it takes him and realizes that it doesn't answer the question, what is the greatest good? What gives your life meaning, purpose, and value? Wisdom doesn't answer it. Pleasure, which he tries, doesn't answer it. The pursuit of greatness, building lots of awesome stuff, doesn't fulfill it, doesn't answer it. Neither does philanthropy and neither does religion. What does? Now, do you see how Ecclesiastes is asking the question to which Jesus is the answer? Asking the question, the more three-dimensionality you understand in the question, the more three-dimensionality you'll understand in the cross of Jesus. Okay, so we were looking at the text last week, and his opening statement, chapter 1, verse 2, is simply that the all is vanity. And then he goes into this, and he also introduces this, very important in verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Again, those toils are the things we've been discussing. And under the sun is more than just a catchphrase. Under the sun is the way that Solomon is doing his theology. No supernatural light, no supernatural revelation, simply what my eye sees under the sun. In other words, to be a theologian or philosopher like Solomon is here in Ecclesiastes, you just need your eyes and your brain and a lot of honesty. The first thing he begins to argue or show, the first way he begins to express that the all is vanity is by describing the meaninglessness of cycles. So if you look at verse 4, and we discussed this last week, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. There's the earth that goes on forever and ever, and one generation comes and goes and comes and goes, and each generation thinks what? We're it. This is the time. This is us. This is life. This is now. This is not going to change. And before we've even finished our boast, we're gone. And the next one's here thinking the same thing and gone. And the next one the same thing. So that humanity itself, as a fallen creature of God, as a corporate creature, is doomed to a cyclical repetition that ultimately amounts to meaninglessness. Now, Solomon was way ahead of the modern philosophers and the modern way of thinking. Prior to the world wars, we are marching toward utopia. Yes, it's generation after generation, but you don't understand. Those generations are building on each other. It coincides with the theory of evolution. We are, as a race, evolving. Okay, there's this minor setback called the war, the Great War, but it's the war to end all wars. This is it. We'll do this thing and then we will have arrived, right? The age of Aquarius. And then comes World War II. And the end of this idea that the generation after generation are building to something great, that we're all standing upon each other's shoulders, reaching into the sky like some sort of human version of the Tower of Babel. Gone. Destroyed. And what slips in that vacuum is postmodernity that we're dealing with today. The point is, Ecclesiastes was written long before the theory of evolution, long before modernity, long before those ideas that have been so prevalent in our recent history, and he already undercuts them. Generation comes and generation goes and generation comes and it's vanity. It's meaningless. So the human race is not evolving. I said, well, yes, we are. We have iPhones now. Yeah, that's true. Okay. The human being, picture him. There we are, the whole corporate mass of Adam, the fallen human being. There we are. And you put it on fast forward, right? And what do you see? You see nothing, you see a papyri, okay, you see the papyri go away, you see an iPhone, right?
What do you see? You see a spear. He's killing people with spears, killing people with animals. Okay, that goes away. He's got a nuclear bomb. But what stays the same? The man. Yeah. We engage in a race like every other creature in microevolution. A flower may change its color over time, or gnats may grow longer wings, or whatever it is, right? But the flower still remains the flower, and the gnat still remains the gnat, even though it adapts in a horizontal sort of way. It never changes into something it's not, in a vertical way. And the same is true for humanity. We may move from the papyrus to the iPhone, from the spear to the nuke, but think about it. That's a horizontal change. We haven't become something we weren't before. We are still the same fallen race, the same fallen man. And that's all included in this point that the Holy Spirit speaks through Solomon. Okay, so that's how it is for human beings. How is it for the world, the cosmos, the solar system? Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. See the cycle? It goes up, it goes down, it goes back around. It's just the endless cycle of the sun. The whole solar system is preaching Ecclesiastes to you every day. The daily grind isn't something people invented. It is literally written into creation. Day and night and day and night and day and night. And again, we talked about how merciless it would be if we had no months, if we had no years, if we had no weeks. If it was, what is today? I don't know. Today's Monday. Today's the day I'm grumpy. Okay, it's Wednesday. It's hump day. It's Friday. Thank God it's Friday. It's Sunday. I go to church. Look at the wonderful variety. But what if we didn't have that week? What if we stripped that construct away, so to speak, and it was just one day after another? What day is it? Monday, Wednesday, or Friday? What are those? It's just the endless march. Okay, so the solar system speaks of an endless march. Even the week, we'll allow ourselves that, speaks of an endless march, just repeating and repeating, and the month the same, and the year the same, the seasons the same, endless repeating, endless repetition. And where does the world go? What changes? What moves? What happens? Where is meaning or purpose? The all is vanity. Peter Kraft makes the point that this is modern man's greatest fear. I think he's onto something. Ancient man's greatest fear was death. I don't want to die. To ancient man, death was the great unknown. Death was is this eternal death? What happens? It's the end. I'm never coming back. Simply death itself was enough to scare to death the ancient man. Now we're not so frightened of death. We're not so frightened of death. We're fairly convinced that there's something on the other side. Those who have, quote-unquote, come back from the dead tell us there's a warm, fuzzy ball of light that loves everyone. So, not that much to fear. I mean, it's a fear, but it's not the fear. Medieval man doesn't so much fear death, he fears hell. This is particularly true. I should say that all this is particularly true in the West. In the West, medieval man fears hell. He's not so afraid of death. Death is just part of it, but what comes after death could be a heck of a lot worse. A heck of a lot worse. It could make death look like a piece of cake. Hell is what medieval man fears. And now we are so enlightened we don't fear hell because we don't believe it exists. Love wins. Right? Rob Bell. We don't believe that hell exists, or if we do, only the really, really bad people go there. Hell is pretty much populated by Satan and Hitler and the other political party, and that's it. That's it. Not a lot of people in hell, not much to be afraid of. Plus, God's the good guy in the sky. I'm a good guy. Can't have that big of an issue with me, right? He's like the great-grandfather. You know, when you were growing up, did you ever fear your grandfather? I never did. I never feared my grandfathers were always kind to me.
That's the beautiful and blessed vocation of a grandfather. My father, oh man, did I fear. Isn't it fascinating that God never says to us, or Jesus never teaches us to pray, our grandfather who art in heaven. God is not once described in the Bible as being our grandfather. That's not the relationship he has with us. Grandfathers are kind and wink and don't think anything bad is going to happen. And they have that luxury because dad is sitting there losing his hair, right? Because mom and dad are there. It's their job to make sure that the stuff doesn't happen. They're bearing the burden, freeing grandpa up. Well, God describes himself as a father because he cares. He disciplines. He cares at that deeper level, at that more profound level, that a grandfather would only care that way if he had to. Okay? But that's not his primary vocation or role. God describes himself as father because he is one to be feared. Well, that goes all in line with the medieval view, with even Jesus' view, to fear the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Okay. And that is what we as modern men have completely lost, is the fear of hell, because we've completely lost God as our Father. We've completely lost God as anyone who means business. So what is left for modern man? Not death, not hell, but this question: is your life meaningless? And that would be the postmodern disease, because postmodernism says, yeah, you create you, you create your reality, everyone's creating reality, and in the end it's self-created and it's meaningless. So meaninglessness becomes our greatest fear, whether we realize it or not. It's why I can preach as sternly and harshly with the full weight of the law about death and hell, and I can actually see people yawning. But I can do the class I did last week and seriously worry if anyone's going to come back. Because Solomon in Ecclesiastes hits home. Meaninglessness hits home. In fact, the purpose-driven life is the number two bestseller, I think, right behind the Bible globally. And I think that the title itself plays on modern man's greatest fears. It promises you that there is a purpose, a meaning. So for all of its self-contradictions and terrible theology, and it's all about God in the first page, and then the next 300 pages, it's all about you. Okay, for all of that, the one thing he's tapped into is the title and the idea that modern man's biggest fear is purposelessness, meaninglessness, vanity. Okay, so the more we study Ecclesiastes and the questions being asked, the arguments being posed, the more we're looking into that black abyss of our own deepest fears as postmodern human beings. All right, so the generation, mankind, goes in cycles going nowhere. The sun, the solar system, our experience of days goes in a cycle, goes nowhere. Then verse 6, the wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. Doing what? Accomplishing what? Nothing. It simply cycles about. So that all you have to do is go out into nature, put your cell phone down for 2 seconds, listen to the wind, and Ecclesiastes is preaching to you. Watch the wind blowing the trees and say, where did it come from? Where's it going? How long have I been blowing? Long before you were ever even born. How long will I be blowing? Long after you are gone. I've been blowing for millennia, I'll be blowing for millennia still. What will you be doing, wind? Nothing. What will you be doing, Pastor Rohde? You'll be dead. Okay? The wind blows and blows in cycles and circuits and is meaninglessness. Likewise, verse 7, all streams run to the sea. They appear to have a point. Follow a stream long enough, you're going to get to a sea. It appears to be going somewhere, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. So the sea doesn't fill up, the rivers don't dry up, there's not an end, but it's a constant pouring into the oceans and a constant evaporation up, clouds going out, dumping the water that flows back down to the ocean, and repeat. And repeat. So if you're a weatherman, you're a theologian. Because you're just tracking the endless cycle of meaninglessness and chance. Okay, what is all of this movement? Great, huge, not to be minimized movements. The great movements of the human race. Billions upon billions of souls spending life and energy and heart and mind. More than that, the cosmos itself, the planet swirling, the sun going up and down, which really, what is up and down? But us going around the sun and the sun in the galaxy and the galaxy just being one of billions of galaxies and all of it moving, or whatever the most recent theory is that we think we know. Energy. Energy beyond what we can even conceive. Same with the wind. Only we could harness that energy efficiently. Same with the water. If only we could harness that energy efficiently. And we've tried, you know, we've got our windmills out in the desert and we've got our dams. But the point is, it is busy. It is full of cosmic, cataclysmic, mind-blowing energy. Work. And verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it, because all of those great efforts that we just mentioned are like you on a treadmill, going nowhere fast, right? Burning calories in a room that on a machine that makes sure that you go nowhere. Happy times. All things are full of weariness. So Solomon looks at it all and says, all the effort, all the toil, all the nothingness, weary, weary. I hear the wind blowing and the water rushing, and I hear weariness. I see the cosmos weary with its action that goes nowhere. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Okay, a poetic way of putting, everything that I see does not fill the void that is within me, the void that I see within humanity, the void that I see within the cosmos and nature itself. I see, but my eye is not satisfied. Never once do I say, there it is. There is the meaning. There is the purpose. Rather, my eye, after seeing all these things, is left empty. My ear, after being filled with all these things, is not filled with hearing that has any meaning or purpose or point. Verse 9, what has been is what will be. The past is going to be the future. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. What you hear under the sun leaves you empty. What you see under the sun leaves you empty, because you're looking at it and it's all empty. It's all expenditure for nothing. So in the tech world, there's great passion and excitement. Look at all of the new innovations. Look at the explosion. Look at the passion. We want people to make stuff, to make life better, to further and advance what we can do and what we can enjoy. Why? There's nothing wrong with that in itself. That's not the criticism. The criticism is why and where does it go? To which people will stare at you dumbfounded. Dumbfounded. Okay, that's a decent place to pause for questions or comments. Are there any?
The air conditioner's back here. Just a wondering question. Since we've seen the cycle that we've been through, is it possible to predict what is next? Will we repeat through again? Or is it just a comment on that?
Yeah, I don't know that there's any prediction. I don't think I see anything like that in Solomon and Ecclesiastes. My own wit and wisdom is you just watch the pendulum swing back and forth. Basically. You know, you see the day become night and the night become day. Back and forth throughout time. What's that? I'm sorry, what was that? Dale, you are Prozac incarnate right now. Thank you.
What do you do with the person who says, things just go over and over again. You know what? I like what I do. I'm just having the pleasure of the moment. That's my meaning. Mm-hmm.
And I probably, Ecclesiastes would say, toil away. Go for it. Now. And again, it would sort of say, so you like it, but just because you like it doesn't mean that's the point or the purpose. Are you sure there's nothing else to it? Yeah, there's nothing else to it. I just like it. Go for it. I mean, there's an indifference. If someone looks at the abyss and says, well, isn't that lovely? I think I'll get another pack of gummy bears. What are you supposed to do? You know, there's the abyss. We're all going to be swallowed up into it. Oh, okay, let me get on my iPhone and Google research this. No. I mean, at a certain point when a human being just comes to terms and says, okay, God sort of says, okay. And that doesn't mean that's where it has to end, but the law has to do its work, or rather reality has to do its work on that person. All right, any other thoughts or questions? Let's go a little further. Okay, so we're still doing the cycle business. And the cycle business sort of undergirds or at least expresses and explains this argument, there is nothing new under the sun. And again, you know, Solomon is wise enough to know that technologies shift and change. A new generation comes and an old passes away. So, you know, look, he's not saying something superficial and stupid. He understands there's newness and novelty in a horizontal sense. You know, he knows that there's a development in technology, a newness under the sun of one generation versus another, etc. But that's not his point at all. His point is that the cycles don't ever end. The cycles of humanity, the cycles of the cosmos, the cycles of time, wind, water, they don't end. There's nothing new under the sun. You know, these are the pieces that you have to play with. Build them in whatever shape you want. Make a house, make a sandbox, make anything that you can with these pieces. They're still the same pieces. That's his point. Verse 10, is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. All right, now this is a shift in argument and gets us to a second point. No remembrance, okay? So if you're tracking sort of in a topical sense, the first has been cycles. The all is vanity. Let's examine this. Cycles. That's a theme, and it's a theme that's going to be recurrent. Here's a new theme. There's no remembrance. All is vanity because there is no remembrance. And that's going to be another theme. So I preached a sermon not long ago where we were remembering Saint Bartholomew, except we don't actually remember Saint Bartholomew at all, right? We remember a few snippets, supposedly what tradition tells us, and maybe a line or two, maybe a little bit more out of Scripture, but not much. And what we are remembering is a shell, a fragment, a tiny little bit of what this man was. So it's as Solomon says, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. There hasn't been any remembrance before, there isn't any remembrance now, there won't be after. We are all doomed to forget. No matter how important you are, the day will come when you are forgotten. For most of us, that's very, very soon. You know, what, the next generation will remember who we are? If we meet our grandkids, maybe they'll remember who we are, and then that's it. I'd go over to my grandma and grandpa's house on my dad's side in college, and they'd show me old pictures of family, you know, going way back. I didn't know those people. I mean, it's fascinating to learn the history and where I came from and all that, but they're strangers. They're complete and utter strangers. They're completely forgotten. I mean, what a tragedy. What a tragedy. And there's no bringing them back. There's no remembrance. No matter how many books you write, they're all going to go away. No matter how many footnotes your name is cited in, it's going to go away. No matter how wonderfully praised your great scientific discovery, theory, philosophy is, it'll probably be upset, overturned. And that's the point that he's driving at. There's no remembrance of former things. Okay? Now, there are some interesting dynamics for us to think about, too. Even when you do remember someone, like you would remember mom and dad who have died, or remember a brother or sister who have died, or remember children of yours who have died, people you know and remember very intimately with detailed memories, it is still impossible to remember them in the sense of remembering and encompassing all of them. The point of all that is because when you go to a funeral or when you read sympathy cards written by Hallmark, you come to realize that once all our medical efforts and science have failed us, we say grandpa or brother or son are alive how? In our memories. As long as we remember them, they are alive in our memories. Now the point is, even if that were true, you can't remember an entire person. God would have to remember that person. God's the only one who can wrap himself around the whole of another person. We're incapable, individually or even collectively as a human race, which is a stunning thing. So let's assume that if we actually could keep someone alive in our memories, the problem is we can't wrap ourselves, even as a collective human race, around one single individual. Now, all of this is very important because the Bible has a lot to say about remembrance, and specifically the remembrance of Jesus. Do you remember the thief on the cross? What does he say? Remember me. Why? Why? Because we, with our pagan idea that grandpa or brother or son are alive in our memories, have stumbled upon a lie of the devil, and a lie of the devil is always wrapped around a grain of truth. And the grain of truth is precisely that. If you can be alive in a memory, but whose? Not man's, individually or collectively, but God's. When God remembers you, you are alive. Therefore, he is the God of the living, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the living, present tense, not the dead, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Because if God remembers us, then we are alive and are alive eternally. And the opposite of that is, what if God forgets us? You're gone. You're outside of life. You have the experience not of God and of life, but of eternal death and of not God. Jesus, one of his disciples asks, or at least one of his followers, I don't know if it was one of the 12, asks him, how many will there be that enter the kingdom of heaven? Lots or a few? And Jesus hates those kinds of questions. Because without the asker probably even recognizing it, the question itself puts the fallen human being on the divine throne judging God. How many are going to get in? How fair are you? How just are you? How merciful are you? Is it acceptable to me? Well, Jesus will never answer that kind of theological question. So he tells a story. And the story is those who find themselves locked out of the city and locked out of the household where the master is. And they cry out. Saul paraphrase. You'll have to look it up in detail. They cry out, Lord, it's us. You ate with us. You drank with us. You were in our city, in our homes. We know you. You know us. And what does the master say? I never knew you. I don't know who you are. Now, most certainly he did, because he ate with them and drank with them in their cities and in their houses. But what has happened that now he doesn't know them where before he did? He has forgotten. So when tempted to ask how many are getting in, is heaven going to be full or empty? Are more people going to heaven or more to hell? Remember Jesus' story, because it all drives to this point. You repent or else you won't get in. Now, in that story, though, is that idea that eternal death is to be separated from the God who is life. And if he doesn't remember you or know you, then you actually are dead. Not annihilated. Not poof, gone, seeing a black screen, nothing like before you were born. No, nothing nearly that merciful. You exist, but in a state of eternal separation from God, and therefore in a state of eternal death, and in a state of eternally being unknown and forgotten by God. Which is a very poignant way of describing what hell actually is. Okay, so everything depends on God's remembering. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Today you will be with me in paradise. To be known by God, to be forgiven by him, to be remembered by him is everything. Everything. All of that is the answer to the question being posed here by Solomon. The question is that there is no remembrance among human beings. We are incapable of remembering even a single other person. We cannot save anyone. We cannot keep anyone alive in our memories. We cannot keep anything alive in our memories. A few, one, two, three generations go by and all that previously was is utterly forgotten. That's futility, that's death, that's hell, that's meaningless. There has to be a different answer. And the answer is found in the lips of that crucified thief. Remember me. If you remember God, if you remember me, Lord Jesus, then I will be with you in paradise forever. All right. So this concept of no remembrance is also a concept of why the all is meaningless. Because one might even say, if we could gather the collective wisdom of the generations, then we truly would evolve. But Solomon's saying you can't actually do that, and we don't actually do that. The collective wisdom of each generation is largely forgotten in the next, and in the subsequent generations is basically completely forgotten. All right. Ready for a new pursuit? Verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Again, under heaven being like under the sun. He's giving us his MO, his way of doing theology, and he's showing us, again, going back to verse 3, what does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? There in verse 3, it's rhetorical, nothing. But here he's saying, look, I pursued this toil, namely wisdom. I applied my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. How does that go, Solomon? It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Wisdom and the pursuit of wisdom is, in the first place, upon Solomon's experience, unhappy business. I mean, for crying out loud, how many happy professors do you know? Just joking. We have lots of professors in here, so I can tease. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. The more you know, in this old cliched phrase, the more you realize you don't know. So it's an unhappy business. Because you can look back and say, I gained so much, and the more I've gained, the more I've realized I don't have a clue. We don't have a clue. It's a lot bigger than I'll ever discover. It's an unhappy business. Verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. Okay, what does the wind do? The wind blows south and north. It around and around goes the wind, and in the circuits it's wind. And I chased after it and chased after it. And if I was a dog, I would be chasing my own tail. Okay. So wisdom is a toil. Now, it sounds like he's dissing wisdom as a pursuit outright. He's not. He's explaining the limitations that he found when pursuing wisdom as the ultimate good, as the meaning of life. Friends, the meaning of life is this: to pursue wisdom, to better yourselves, to participate in the great collective that is the human race, compiling its wisdom and knowledge and passing it on and evolving and doing great things. Okay? What he's doing is saying it's not that great. Pursue it, it's not wrong, but it's an unhappy business. And ultimately, you're a dog chasing after your own tail. It's vanity and it's chasing after the wind that goes around and around in circles. Great line. I don't know if Radiohead quoted it directly, intentionally or not. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is crooked cannot be made straight. Which is sort of one of those inexhaustible phrases. Okay, so immediately in context, if the what is wisdom, then the point is you want wisdom to go somewhere, but it doesn't. By nature is crooked, it's not straight, you can't make it straight. Deeper than that is the reflection on human nature itself, of which wisdom is a part. What is crooked cannot be made straight, not by force of will, not by learning, not by wisdom, not by applying yourself. There's no magic, there's no secret. People get rich selling books, churches get huge by authors selling books. But in the end, what is crooked cannot be made straight. It's not the answer. Self-improvement, more broadly, is not the answer. Is it bad? No. Improve away. But at the same time, don't be deluded into thinking that what was once crooked, you've now made straight. And we know that even as Christians deeply, as you pursue sanctification, as you attempt to crucify the sinful flesh within you with its desires, right? The second you crucify and put away some external manifestation or act is also the second you realize that the desire hasn't gone away. You know, when the alcoholic stops drinking and throws it all out and checks into a program, he doesn't stop desiring alcohol, does he? And so it is with all sins. Put away the external. That's good. Do it. It's healthy. It's better for you and for the people around you. It's what we're to do as Christians. It's part of our vocation, being conformed into the image of Christ. And yet, what is crooked cannot be made straight. Realize that the only thing that is going to make you straight, because you are actually crooked, is for you, the crooked creature, to be put to death and raised new as the straight creature in the resurrection of the dead. In other words, the ultimate and only answer is for us to be crucified, buried with Christ, and raised with Him. Otherwise, what is crooked cannot be made straight. And what is lacking cannot be counted. Which again is sort of an inexhaustible thought. But it's the idea that, in part, that we human beings are so focused on what we have or what we can do that we don't realize the great void, the lacking that cannot be counted. Right? No one had computers in their homes. Then everyone had a personal computer. See, haven't we done a great thing? Then everyone's personal computer went to a laptop. Look at this. Then everyone's laptop went to a phone. Woo! The next thing is wearables. It'll be your watch. And the thing after that is it'll just be implanted so you see it in your eye, you know? Google will see everything you see and tell you all you need to know. And all of these great advances as we perceive them, these great leaps in wisdom and technology, Solomon's point is it's sort of like an ant discovering a new twig. An ant that finds a pea and carries it home and everyone goes, "Whoa, we've never seen this before, super!" In other words, what is lacking, what we don't know that we could have, is so great, so immense. Why? Because we're so blinded by the little things we can do, making ourselves in our own mind like this God that has done this incredibly awesome and immense thing. We're blinded to the fact that we're an ant picking up a pea, and that's our greatest accomplishment. What is lacking cannot be counted. The more you learn, the less you know. The more you discover, the more you learn that you haven't discovered. You conquer one disease and you realize there's many more. As soon as you get one eradicated, more arrive. There's constantly, constantly more. What is lacking cannot be counted. All right, so this is a two-line expression of the futility of wisdom and why the pursuit of wisdom is fine and may in some ways be superior to other pursuits, and yet it doesn't ultimately go anywhere. It's not ultimately the answer to the meaning or purpose of life. Verse 16, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and to know folly. The Lutheran Study Bible makes this point, that in the pursuit of wisdom, human wisdom, wisdom apart from the wisdom of God, that wisdom has a way of, when one acquires too much of it, of creating madness and folly. How can that be? How can that be? Some of the greatest philosophers who reject outright the wisdom of God but pursue the wisdom of reason, the wisdom that human beings can accomplish to its utmost, also become mad. or end up saying the most ridiculously stupid things imaginable. Folly. So the pursuit of wisdom brings with it madness and folly, close cousins, which is strange but true. So eugenics, remember that? A great movement of wisdom. We know that the human race is evolving. It's evolving and we're having too many people. It's evolving and we want to control the direction it's evolving. We want it to evolve in this way and not another way. How are we going to do this with the knowledge we have and the technology we've gained? Prophylactics, birth control, in some countries, designating those who are weak and to be culled out, who are not either fit for breeding and propagating the human race and its upward track, or have no business at all being part of the human race. This whole movement is created by wisdom, and it brings nothing but madness, folly, and atrocity to the human race. What is it that brings wars and conflicts to the earth? We say, oh, it's just the stupidity of men. If women ruled the world, then we wouldn't have wars. Well, it's not the stupidity of man. It's precisely the opposite. I mean, the people in the Pentagon, in the secret room, deciding who's going to get the next smart bomb aren't going, They're not stupid. It's wisdom. It's the height, peak, and epitome of human wisdom that leads us into violent encounters with one another, that leads us into folly and madness of all sort. We call it stupidity, but that's actually inaccurate. It's wisdom that is also madness and folly. Okay, verse 17, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. They're all the same. I perceive that this also is but a striving for the wind. For in much wisdom there is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Which I think is just observably true. People who have experienced enough of life, drank deeply of it, thought deeply of it, carry with them a certain gravity, a certain seriousness. Because why? Wisdom brings with it vexation. The increase of knowledge increases sorrow. So, again, Solomon's point, his larger argument, is pursue wisdom. It's good for you to pursue wisdom. It might even be superior than other toils and pursuits. But know that it comes with a curse. It can't be the greatest good. It can't be the ultimate answer because in and of itself it brings vexation and sorrow and unhappiness and ultimately causes one to strive after the wind. Chase one's own tail in circles. Okay? Questions or comments? Very quickly. We can take one or two if there are any. Next week, we move with Solomon from the pursuit of wisdom to the pursuit of pleasure. Pleasure. But again, not the crass, like, me caveman, me want cheeseburger. But the pursuit of pleasure as an art and a science and as a way of life. And we'll see that it, too, does not quite answer the question, what is the meaning and purpose of your existence in life? The Lord be with you.